This is Stateside. I'm Lester Grammond for Cynthia Candy. You know, we all want to fix a problem, and we come up with a plan, and we come up with the tools, and we get to work. But what if the problem we need to fix is us? I recently read an article about climate change, which challenged my thinking about what needs to be done to curtail the greenhouse gas emissions causing global heating. The title of the piece in Behavioral Scientist is Climate Change and Our Emerging Cultural Shift. The author is Andrew Hoffman, and he joins us now. Welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, it's good to be here.
All right. You write, you give talks about attitudes about climate change. And in this piece you wrote, you mentioned you get a lot of hate mail and angry people approaching you. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, it came after when I first started writing about this. And it was funny. I wrote an article in a journal you probably never heard of called Organizational Dynamics. And it came out and it did what academic journal articles do. It sit someplace and no one reads it. And then there was an analogy in there to the cultural shift around climate change being akin to the cultural shift around the abolition of slavery, recognizing that there are some distinct differences between right. the cruelty of one race against another, but there are interesting parallels. And the paper went out, put a line on my resume, do what academics do, and then the New York Times picked it up, that slavery abolition thing. And then Scientific American and Time Magazine. I'm thinking, oh, this is cool. I'm a public intellectual. And then someone emailed me and said, I see Mark Morano is taking his hits at you. And I was new to this. And I said, who's Mark Morano? And he said, he used to work for James Inhofe. He used to work for Rush Limbaugh. He has a page called climatedepot.com. I think you better go look at it. I went. The coverage of the article was entirely climate skeptics are the moral equivalent of slave owners and my email address. And the emails start pouring in.
Right. Yeah. You also had some personal encounters that you mentioned. Yeah. Tell us about one of those. And I like these because this gets to a big part of the cultural difference between academics like yourself and the religious folks who are kind of caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, if you will, on this. Even if they feel that, you know, the science is correct and climate warming is happening, they can't take that back to the church because, right.
Well, maybe yes or no. I mean, where I'm going in this paper is that if it connects to our religious beliefs, it will motivate action in ways that will be far more powerful.
But you're talking about trying to change somebody's dogma. We're going to get into that a little bit. But tell me about one of these experiences where you had to had somebody who basically saying, you're blaspheming my religion by claiming that the earth is warming and we're causing it and we can do something about it.
Well, a lot of my work has been around why do people reject the science of climate change? And the conclusion of this work is that for many people, the debate is not about CO2. It's not about climate models. It's about worldviews that they feel are threatened. One of the major worldviews that some people feel is threatened is their belief in God. And to me, that's so powerful to make this point, because what do we do when we're faced with someone who doesn't believe in climate change? We give them more scientific data. But if they're hearing a threat to their belief in God, you're missing the point and you're never going to get through to them.
So why is it a threat to their belief in God?
Well, so, you know, Rush Limbaugh devoted an entire episode of a show to the idea that you can't believe in God and believe in climate change at the same time, because we are not in charge out there. God is in charge out there. We live by his divine providence. And to suggest otherwise is extreme hubris. Or the millennia-old doctrine in there, right here in Ann Arbor. Someone held up a Bible in front of me in one of my talks and said, God promised Noah he would not flood the earth again. The seas cannot be rising. Or I gave a talk out towards Grand Rapids, and a woman came to me, and she was struggling because she said, you know, I believe in science, I believe in climate change, but I come from a deeply fundamentalist family, and they look at climate change through the lens of revelations, and if revelations brings the world to an end through fire, and climate change looks like it's going that way, maybe this is God's will, and why should we fight it? And that really speaks, particularly within academia, a lot of people are dismissive of religion. Yet, if you're going against someone's deeply held religious beliefs, or their deeply philosophical beliefs, we could be talking about the Bible or the Torah, we can also be talking about Rousseau or Locke.
Right.
You know, and that's the key. What is our conception of our place on earth, our purpose for being here? Climate change goes that deep, and the broader issue goes that deep, which is the Anthropocene.
Which, yeah, we need to explain that.
Yeah.
And I'll get to it, I promise.
I was careful not to put that in the title because that was just going to scare people away.
So as I mentioned, when we're faced with a problem, we want to get our tools to fix it. And in the case of climate change, you know, our tools are windmills and solar panels. Yeah. And tech can fix this, can't it?
It can address symptoms. it won't address the problem. The Tesla is a great car, but it's still a car. And the answer is not more cars. The answer is thinking differently about mobility. The answer comes down to a deep shift in our culture, which the point I make in the paper is on a scale akin to the Enlightenment or the Scientific Revolution or the Protestant Reformation. And the key to that analogy, there are several, but those were fundamental shifts in our cultural beliefs as a species, a fundamental shift in our perception of the environment, and a fundamental shift in how we saw the two connected. And importantly, those shifts took 100 years. And so when people say, you know, in all due respect to James Hansen, and I'll get attacked for this, but when he said, open the Keystone Pipeline and it's game over for the planet, that is not helpful, nor is it accurate. We can't think about this as a sprint. This is a marathon. I believe in the paper, the shift has begun. And it's begun in some hard to see, perhaps even imperceptible ways, but it has begun. And there's a quote I love from William Gibson. He says that the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed.
Right. Yeah.
And so there are shifts occurring, but many people did not know the Enlightenment or the Scientific Revolution were happening at the time. Those terms very often were coined years after, centuries after, by historians trying to make sense out of this period of tumult. So we may not know what's happening right now.
You're talking about a re-enlightenment.
A re-enlightenment. And I, you know, I've gotten blowback on using that term because a lot of people look at enlightenment as having a lot of political baggage because they see that as the beginning of colonialism, white man's burden, and that's not what I'm trying to say here. But I do think the analogy is apropos because it's that big. Aldo Leopold, who was an ecologist at the University of Wisconsin, he wrote, "No important change in ethics was ever accomplished without an internal change in our intellectual emphasis, loyalties, affections, and convictions. The proof that conservation has not yet touched these foundations of conduct lies in the fact that philosophy and religion have not yet heard of it. In our attempt to make conservation easy, we have made it trivial." And I look at climate change right now, and in an attempt to make climate change easy, we have made it trivial. Buy an electric car, I can now thump my chest, I am virtuous, I've addressed the problem, I'm living the good life, and it's you bad people that are driving the SUV. If you drove an electric, the world will be a wonderful place, and it's not going to work that way.
So you're asking us for life changes that some people will see as sacrifice. Yep. So how is that going to win friends and influence people?
I'm just pointing out the obvious reality. I'm not here to win friends and influence people.
And we should point out, you're not just talking about climate change, but you're talking about a lot of the different things that are contributing to a really dire situation for this planet and for the human race.
But, and we're talking about a culture change that, you know, humans are quite adaptive. I mentioned J.B. McKinnon's book, The Once and Future World, where he points out that we're born into a world, we take it for granted, we watch it change before our eyes, we become sad at the decay, the next generation is born into a world they accept, and then they watch it, and that cycle repeats itself. But the bigger issue here, and if I can rephrase the climate change question into a cultural question, do you believe that we as a species have grown to such numbers and our technology to such power that we can alter the global climate? If you answer yes, that's a huge cultural shift. It's huge. And the idea that we merely need to buy an electric car and live our lives as we always have, that's not going to happen. Now, is it sacrifice or is it just adaptation? We live lives right now that people 100 years ago would find appalling. I love to point out that when Graham Bell started putting up telephone poles, people were really offended. They were cutting them down. There were mayors around the country saying, cut those poles down. He hired Pinkerton guards to protect the poles. Now we take them for granted. Is that a sacrifice? I don't think so. And so where are we going with mobility, with the electric grid, with food? There are changes. They're happening around us right now. And that's where I see the enlightenment taking place, the re-enlightenment taking place.
So what you're talking about is a little hard to get your arms around. So I'm going to use a different metaphor here. What kind of lens should we be looking through to enable us to see what you're talking about?
Well, to begin with, is just recognizing that this is much bigger and much deeper. The answer is not going to, I mean, the market is expedient. If I put a price on this, if I put a price on carbon, it's an important step. The culture will shift with that. They go hand in hand. Anthony Giddens wrote about structuration theory that culture and technology are in like this spiral. And as we change technology, it changes culture in ways very often we didn't anticipate. The birth control pill brings about the sexual revolution, and it continues. The cotton gin, in many ways, made the Civil War possible because slavery was dying under its own weight. The printing press created the Reformation. And so recognition of the Anthropocene, and it's more than climate change, it's species extinction, it's nitrogen runoff.
I was going to say, define what Anthropocene means.
So the Anthropocene is, geophysical scientists have argued that we've left the Holocene, we've entered the Anthropocene, we've entered a new geological epoch. This is not a philosophical statement. They actually have to do it through the geological strata on the Earth. So the way I like to describe it, if we died as a species today, in 1,000 years from now, archaeologists start digging, they will hit a layer and they will say, what happened here? What happened here is humans. They'll find radioactive isotopes. That's important because when they made the proposal that we're in the Anthropocene, they have to define something they call the golden spike. Is an actual place where we can actually show you the geological strata change. They're putting the golden spike at the first atomic bomb because that just spread radioactive isotopes around the Earth. And so now it's going through formal approval. But within the Anthropocene, they define 9 planetary boundaries. These are boundaries we should not cross if we want to maintain a stable living environment for humans and other life forms. And one is in retreat, ozone depletion. 3 of them we're crossing. Climate change, nitrogen. We produce more nitrogen than natural processes. We put it in farms. We know this in Michigan, the algae blooms, the dead zone in the Mississippi River, and species extinction. Scientists say we're in the middle of a sixth mass extinction.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the Anthropocene. And sometimes you need to hear it in a way that just really shocks you into, oh, wait, something's weird here, because we take things for granted. Like here in Michigan, we take for granted you can't eat fish out of the lakes because of mercury and other kinds of pollution. We take that for granted.
I'm actually surprised when I talk to people that they don't realize that there are places in this state where there's DDT in the fish at a level that we can't eat the fish. Yeah. We've got PCBs, we've got dioxins, now we've got PFAS that we know about, and many other chemicals in fish at high enough levels that you either should not eat it at all, or you should limit your intake to maybe 1 or 2 fish a month.
And if you're a pregnant woman, don't even go near it. And we take that for granted.
Yeah, that's normal now.
Yeah. And I put it in the paper. I was talking to a research chemist at a pharmaceutical company, and he said very matter-of-factly, he said, you know, there's measurable levels of ibuprofen in the Mediterranean Sea. And I was like, whoa. And he said, hey, that doesn't concern us. It's a fairly benign compound. What worries us is birth control pills and antidepressants. You take a drug, pass through your system, treatment plant can't handle it, enters the aquatic ecosystem, changes the flora and the fauna.
Yeah, my colleague Rebecca Williams has reported on this a few times. It's happening here. We can detect those pharmaceuticals in the water in Michigan.
Biologists were looking at salmon in Puget Sound 2 years ago, and they found Prozac. They found 40 prescription drugs. They even found cocaine. And guess what? That salmon's ending up on your restaurant dinner plate. And that's the Anthropocene.
And who knows what kind of impact it's having on the evolution of fish and amphibians and reptiles.
And we haven't even talked about plastics. I mean, scientists predict that by 2050, believe it or not, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish by weight. And you need these kind of statistics to say, holy smokes, what's going on? Yet we'll get numb to that too. You know, we'll just sort of accept that.
I thought when the study came out that showed microplastics in bottled water, in tap water, in beer, that there would be this huge outrage, but apparently everybody feels like, well it's going to be filtered out. I mean, you know, it's just not going to be a problem. All right, so we've talked about this huge shift, a planetary shift. How can you even begin to make a paradigm shift of this magnitude in people's culture?
What I'm saying in the paper is religion is key here. So we started talking about hate mail and religion is the obstacle. And I'm saying religion is a solution and philosophy is a solution. My argument does not leave out secular humanists. You don't have to believe in God, but it comes down to our fundamental belief about why are we here? It's really existential questions. And
are we here to dominate or are we here to be good stewards?
Right. And so I fixated on Pope Francis's encyclical letter Laudato Si. And I think it's an interesting document for really laying out a set of moral beliefs that we are, he doesn't use the word Anthropocene, but he is pointing out that we are starting to live in a world that is not very nice. We are damaging it. I love in the Catholic Catechism where they say pollution is actually theft from future generations. this is the beginning of really starting to examine some deeper questions around, well, if climate change is real, what does it mean for me mowing my lawn in Ann Arbor? That has impact for people in low-lying areas of Bangladesh. Now we're going to start to have a very serious conversation. How do you talk to people in small island states who are starting to look at the end of their habitable environment? And they didn't even do it. I mean, that's an important element here, too, is that the poor people that are getting hit by this are ones that didn't even do this. And so that really starts to get us to reexamine issues around ethics, around morals, in ways that we really haven't done, and I don't think we're fully prepared to do. But when you put it on that plane, you start to see that there's something really big here. And how can we come to terms with it? That's, again, if people hear about this from the church, the mosque, the synagogue, the temple, it connects to their deepest sense of who they are. And then get out of the way, because religion can explain, you know, Nelson Mandela. Rationality can't. Religion can explain Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War and holding firm to the idea of keeping the Union together. Rationality does not. And I put far more hope in faith to get us through the big challenges we have than a logical calculation that the odds are in my favor.
And my prediction is you're going to get hate mail from all sides just based on this one conversation. I mean, it's people do not want to be challenged like this, but what else can you do when you're faced with the kind of things we're faced?
When I first started getting hate mail, someone gave me a quote, and I haven't been able to attribute it. They told me it was from Winston Churchill. I haven't been able to verify it, but it's a wonderful quote. It says, "If you're not offending anyone, you never took a stand." And it's an important quote for any academic who wants to get into the public debate. I have many scientists who tell me, oh, my work is not political. And my answer is, if you're challenging the way people think or behave, you are by definition political, and people will push back. If they don't push back, you didn't say anything important. And so accept that as part of the domain. And there's two other quotes that I really love. I heard one from Paul Newman, of all people. He said, if you don't have enemies, you don't have character. Now, I might flop that a little bit. There are people with enemies that deserve them. But if you have character, if you're standing up for what you think is right, you will have enemies. Or another one, I heard a friend say this a couple of months ago, and I said, you got to repeat that. And he said, you only get shot at when you're over the target. All of them speak to the idea that if you're saying something important, you're challenging how people think. If you challenge how people think, they're not going to like it. But change is painful. Change is hard. And this argument in this article, it applies to all of us. Even the most liberal who's just accepted climate change lock, stock, and barrel, if you think the answer is a windmill and an electric car, you're not thinking big enough.
Andrew Hoffman is a professor at the University of Michigan with joint appointments at the Ross School of Business and the School for Environment and Sustainability. He's the author of several books, including How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, thanks, Lester. It's a pleasure to be here.